Next, I want to welcome Maheen Haidar. She's going to be speaking sort of about the personal and the national impact. Maheen is a doctoral candidate at the Department of Sociology at Boston College, where she studies the processes of immigration and acculturation and issues of race and ethnicity. She's also a CLOW graduate fellow at the CLOW Center for the Study of Constitutional Democracy. Her research focuses on the integration experiences of high-skilled non-white Muslim immigrants, specifically Pakistani migrants in the U.S., and looks at the contemporary changes in the immigrant experience that has increasingly become more diverse and complex around the issues of race, religion, and skill levels. She's also researching the role of mass media, in particular Hollywood films, that portray racialized identities of Muslims and Arabs grounded in the war on terror. Prior to coming to Boston College, she received a master's in social development from the University of Sussex and holds a bachelor's in software engineering from Pakistan. Please help me welcome Maheen.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm going to follow up on a lot of points that have been said before, but I think when Barbara wanted me to talk about this, she said, talk about the personal and the global impacts of immigration. And that's what immigration is, like my entire life, everyone's life. This is such an important space right now, and this is such an emotional topic for all of us because what it represents in terms of all of our life histories. So I think it was really interesting when she was like, talk about the global and the personal. And so she was like, there are a couple of things I want you to touch upon. So there are four dimensions that I'm going to be looking at. The global compact on migration. I'm going to get over it. I'm going to get into details. Rachel was fabulously, I was so glad that there was a law person here to talk about the travel ban, the Muslim ban, and the refugee ban, DACA. And then international students, because that's a very important part of how we understand immigration. So what is it in immigration that we sort of have forgotten when you're talking about the Trump era? Dehumanizing the humanness in immigration. That was one thing that I came up with. And then I was like, wait, no. Humanness seems like an attribute that you associate with the human, right? So that's like a value. So you're actually dehumanizing the human in immigration. So when you, again, now look at these four contexts, you're actually dehumanizing the very human. We've all talked about how stressful the last whole year has been, right? Yesterday, day before yesterday, it's just like it keeps on going crazy. And especially if you're doing a dissertation and research on all this, you're like editing and changing your dissertation proposal dates because you're like, wait, there's another crap. That's basically been my life story. So what is it? What's the global compact on migration? This was actually 2 days ago. I don't know if you know about this, but the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants was adopted in September 2016. So this came out. This is the statement. The New York Declaration contains numerous provisions that are inconsistent with U.S. immigration and refugee policies and the Trump administration immigration policies. As a result, President Donald Trump determined that the U.S. would end its participation in the contract process that aims to reach international consensus at the UN in 2018. So again, you're talking about refugees, you're talking about displaced individuals, you're talking about the world that's extremely become more chaotic because of everything that's been grounded in the war on terror. So you're talking about these refugees and the United States pulling out at this very important moment. So that's what the global compact. Where does that leave us? And sort of the US Supreme Court decision sort of makes more sense. All right. Sorry, more bad news. Travel ban. Okay. So Rachel was really great. Thank you. Again, we're going over all of these. So it's so interesting that you constantly hear the 1.0, 2.0, Muslim ban, refugees, and they're so much interconnected because they're sort of one and the same thing. And just so I think it's important when I'm talking about dehumanizing the human in immigration, you're focusing on the language of immigration that's specifically changed. So I want you to observe specifically the title, Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. You have these were the seven countries that came out that were sort of put in initially in the travel ban 1.0. And then at that time, travelers were detained and up to 60,000 visas were provisionally revoked, right? Because initially when it came out, and if you were traveling or you were at the airport, it wasn't clear if what kind of visa were you on. You were part of these countries and that's it, you were stuck. So it was like sort of like all these individuals, children, women, men, I want to repeat these constantly, the human process, all these individuals that were constantly stuck and weren't sure, where do I go next? Students studying in colleges, what do I do now? Do I go home? Do I not? These are like life decisions that you're actually asking parents and individuals to make simultaneously at one point. So let's not forget the emotional cost of immigration. And I think that's what I want to remind you here today, consistently. Then, the refugee ban was, of course, part of the travel ban. And then it sort of suspended. You had, like as Rachel clarified, I'm going to get into the refugee ban a little more in detail, a little more. But it's sort of interesting how the numbers were minimized so drastically from Obama placed the cap to 110,000, and that was put to 50,000. So I think that reduction sort of speaks about, like, when you're talking about how you're delegitimizing the struggle of the refugee, because nobody wants to leave their home for fun. So when you're a refugee, you're probably in a lot of chaos already. All right. And yes, the Syrian refugees were completely banned. This is just a little graph, and this is just 1.0. So I just want to, the reason that I'm showing this is so that you can understand, like, when this was going on, what it meant to be a traveler from these particular parts of the world. Travel ban 2.0, again, you had a similar, you had a very, one country was dropped out, which was Iraq in particular, and the question was, well, the U.S. has played such, or Iraq has played such an important role in the war on terror, so you got to sort of give some value to Iraqis for their sacrifice. So they were, like, put into a different bracket where they were like, well, we'll put you in the hyper-surveillance belt, extreme vetting, right? So it's important. I actually recommend that it's very easy to read. Go read the laws. Like, just, thanks for the talk. But I sort of, this is not what we do, like, as scholarly people. Like, we're reading about theories and stuff. But it's so interesting to read the language of the law on how extreme vetting, how corporations between countries sort of defines the future of these individuals that we're dealing with every other day. Okay, and then the travel ban, the refugee ban was also in place. I'm going to talk about travel ban 3.0. What happens with travel ban 3.0? You have Sudan was also dropped off in travel ban 3.0, and so you don't have Sudan, you don't have Iraq, but you have Chad now. So you have, again, six Muslim majority countries, Venezuela, and then North Korea. So that was not surprising to have North Korea in there, but sort of a repetition of how the ban specifically were focusing, targeting Muslim majority countries in the Middle East already engulfed by the war on terror. So it's like sort of like very contradictory to what it's entailing. Just a little in terms of the refugees. Because Obama administration in 2026, oops, 5 minutes, okay. So, let me rush this word. So it's interesting how the refugees sort of were part of these travel bans. And as sort of, Rachel's already mentioned this, but there are 11, these are the 11 countries actually, that are now part, that are deemed as high risk. And the reason that I have these countries over here repeatedly is you see a constant pattern, a constant repetition of what countries are part of the travel ban, what countries are part of the refugee ban, and sort of like, again, delegitimizing the human processes, the emotional cost of why people are moving from one place to another. I think it's important also to look at DACA, because DACA sort of often looked, it's sort of interesting when you're talking about the war on terror, 9/11, you have the Muslim experience, which has also sort of gained a certain kind of privilege in the class content because of the diversity and kind of immigrants that are coming in, how educated they are. And then the DACA immigrants are completely overlooked because you're looking at an age group of 16 to 31, undocumented, a lower socioeconomic status. So sort of that also delegitimizes their status. So when you are looking at the DACA experience, it's also important to look at how vulnerable these young adults were when they're like put in that country. So I think it's important to sort of like consistently realize what impact it has on kids who are in school, who are trying to go to school, who are trying to make their living, who are trying to get their driver's license, while not being from this part, not having been born in the United States, but having known no other country but the United States. So I think that places a very important places them in a very important location in how we're looking at them as immigrants. So it's also interesting. There's an excellent book, by the way, by Robert Gonzalez, Lives in Limbos. I definitely recommend if you're studying undocumented immigrants, illegal migration, please look at it and how it's sort of like looked upon and how it's grouped under illegality of stuff, because that's the problem with the language of immigration. There's not, you know. So it's interesting, but DACA was very important because it enabled economic mobility, economic integration, white-collar jobs for these individuals that were sort of like completely looked down upon for having a very unsettled legal status. So it did give an opportunity towards that. I think after DACA, there are like 5 other bills pending in the state. So I haven't like read all of them, but Rachel probably knows more about this. But it's sort of interesting that all these 5 bills are offering a period of conditional permanent residency. It's very unclear, considering the current circumstances, everything is unclear. So, but it does question of what people are actually going through when they're talking about DACA, when they're talking about Muslim ban, travel ban, refugee ban. So international students, let's not leave them out, right? Because I'm one. It's interesting. How many people, sorry, it might take a little longer. How many people have applied, how many people are not American citizens right here? What is the process of getting, was it easy getting a visa? It wasn't. It's very important to understand. The reason I'm asking these questions is it's not easy to get a visa to the United States, even when it was Obama's era, is because that's how immigration processes work. And there is a certain legitimization in that way of how these structural systems operate. So it's sort of, when you have international students in any country, it's important because they have like a huge economic impact. Huge economic impact, right? And they're creating jobs, they're coming F1, J1, like so much, they're spending money. So it's important of how valuable they are to the economy of that particular country, right? So just, here's a table. So this basically shows of how many jobs were created, what was the billion dollar impact of all these students coming to the U.S., right? So what's interesting now is that even though the U.S. continues to be, even the 2016-2017, like the topmost destination for like international students, the actual number of international students has decreased, reason being because there's like a 3% decrease in the actual new enrollment because there's actually older students who are getting OPTs. So I don't know if this makes sense to you. It's like lesser students are coming in, but the ones who are staying are getting OPTs. So that sort of is the reason why there's an increase. So it will be very, very interesting.
OPT, what is that?
Oh, sorry. I apologize. It's an optional training program. So we all come in either as F1 visas or J1 visas. F1 visas are granted by the institutions in process. And then F1 visas, after you graduate, you are allowed to be, to sort of, in order to get a job, you're given an intermediate status. That's called the OPT, right? And then, so you're on it for either 2 years if you're from a STEM part, or you're on 1 year if you're, like, doing social sciences like me, right? So it's sort of interesting to see how that operates. So the increase is primarily because they're counting the OPTs, not the newer enrollment trends. And then again, there is a decline in number of students coming from Saudi Arabia and Brazil, but it also like sort of adds to the decline in number. What is too worrying? So I think this is what matters here, and connecting the dots is really important. The United States offers Fulbright scholarship programs to countries around the world, right? And they're really, really important Fulbright programs. These programs are being canceled. Canceled in terms of the fact. So these are the ones that are canceling the 4-year and the 6 years and the 7-year programs. So you will still have the semester exchange, the 1-month exchange, but you will have all these in these particular countries. And it's not surprising to read what these countries are, right? Sort of, you see a reduction in the Fulbright scholarship program for the 2018-2019 year. So what does that entail for high-skilled immigration, right? These are very important variables. So what does this all mean? A dear friend of mine on Facebook today posted something like trauma, and I was like, it is a collective trauma, like going through immigration, listening about immigration, studying immigration, right? So it's like this process where you're sort of constantly being questioned because they're exclusionary, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-Mexican, anti-immigrant policies per se, right? So I think it's important to acknowledge the burden that's on the people and what it means when you're like talking to immigrants, what people are going through, what students in your classes are going through, or what even your teachers are going through when they're talking about this. So again, I think the question is beyond legal and illegal now. The question is regardly about religion and ethnicity and race, definitely, and I think it's time that we talk about it. But the good news is, there is resilience. There is a lot of resilience. I've seen more social movements in the United States. I came here in 2011, so there's a lot more that I've seen here than I have seen before. Muslims, non-white, brown, Jews, everyone coming together, sort of like talking about the histories. Like, it's so interesting. Like, Aisha talks about histories, and it's like all the histories, the Jewish groups coming together with the Muslim groups, right, the Mexican groups. So it's like you see a resilience and a coalition building, not across religious groups, but across classes. And I think that's a very important part of what we're going through. Thank you.